63. The Die Hard. Radovich was a long-time loser, an all-around loser. It had started back in the 30s, lectures cancelled, books rejected, and to cap it all, he was plagued by ill health. He had a splinter from one of Kolchak's shells in his chest. He had suffered from a duodenal ulcer for 15 years, and every morning for many years past he had carried out the excruciating procedure of irrigating his stomach through the esophagus, without which he could not eat and go on living. But Radovich's misfortunes were also his salvation. A conspicuous figure in Comintern circles, he had survived in the critical years only because he had never set foot outside a hospital. Illness had been his refuge again in the past year, when all the Serbs left in the Soviet Union had either been dragooned into the anti-Tito movement or thrown into jail. Realizing how equivocal his position was, Radovich made a superhuman effort to restrain himself to say nothing, to avoid being drawn into fanatical disputes, to live the subdued life of an invalid. Now, too, he was holding himself in check, helped by the smoker's table. This was a small oval table of dark wood, placed conveniently in the study to hold cigarette papers and a roller for filling them, a selection of pipes in a rack, and a mother-of-pearl ashtray. Near the table stood a tobacco cabinet of Karelian birchwood, with numerous drawers containing a variety of cigarettes with cardboard mouthpieces, cigarettes without mouthpieces, cigars, pipe tobaccos, and even snuff. Listening in silence to Slavuta's account of preparations for biological warfare and the hideous crimes of Japanese officers against humanity, Radovich eagerly sniffed the contents of the drawers, trying to decide what to settle for. Smoking was suicide, strictly forbidden by all his doctors. But since he was also forbidden to drink or to eat, he had eaten practically nothing that evening. His sense of smell and his taste buds were particularly sensitive to shades of difference between tobaccos. Life without smoking seemed flat. In his straitened circumstances, he preferred to buy homegrown tobacco in peasant markets and roll his own cigarettes in newspaper. As an evacuee in Stedley Tamak, he used to buy a leaf of homegrown from some old man with a private plot and dry it and cut it himself. Preparing his tobacco helped him to think in the empty hours of bachelorhood. If Radovich had put his oar in, he would not in fact have said anything very terrible. His own views were not so far away from what the state required people to think. But Stalin's party, which was even less tolerant of fine shades of difference than of clashing colours, would have beheaded him in a trice for the smidgen of difference between them. Luckily, he managed to contain himself, and the conversation moved on from the Japanese to the relative merits of particular cigars, of which Slavuta knew so little that he almost choked on an incautious puff, to the fact that although the number of prosecutors grew from year to year, their work steadily increased. "What do the crime statistics have to say?" Radovich asked, an apparently casual question. His parchment-like features were expressionless. The crime statistics had nothing to say. They were dumb, they were invisible, and nobody knew whether they still existed. Which did not prevent Slavuta from saying, "The statistics tell us that the number of crimes is going down." He had not seen the actual figures, but he had read what the papers had to say about them. He added, just as sincerely, "But there's still plenty of crime. It's a legacy from the old regime. The people are very corrupt, corrupted by bourgeois ideology." 3/4 of those who went through the courts were born after 1917, but this did not enter Slavuta's head. It was not something he had read. Makarygin tossed his head. He didn't need to be told this. "When Vladimir Ilyich told us that the Cultural Revolution would be much more difficult than the October Revolution, we couldn't take it in. We realize now how far-sighted he was." Makarygin had a backless head and prominent ears. They puffed away companionably, filling the study with smoke. Half of Makarygin's small, highly polished desk was occupied by a big inkstand with a representation almost 1/2 meter high of the Spassky Tower, complete with clock and star. The 2 massive inkwells, made to look like turrets on the Kremlin wall, were dry. It was a long time since Makarygin had done any writing at home. He had plenty of time during office hours, and he wrote his letters with a fountain pen. Behind the glass doors of the Riga bookcases stood legal codes, collections of laws, sets of Soviet state and law, the great Soviet encyclopedia, the old erroneous edition, complete with enemies of the people, the new great Soviet encyclopedia, still with enemies of the people, and the small encyclopedia, also with mistakes and also containing enemies of the people. It was a long time since Makarygin had opened any of these volumes, because all of them, including the still officially operative but in fact hopelessly out-of-date Criminal Code of 1926, had been felicitously replaced by a bundle of supremely important and, for the most part, secret instructions, each of which he knew by its number, 083 or 005/2742. These instructions, encapsulating all the wisdom of the judicial system, he kept in a single small file in his office. Here, in his study, books were kept not to be read, but to inspire respect. The books Makarygin did read, in bed, on trains, at health resorts, were detective stories, which he kept hidden in a windowless cabinet. A big portrait of Stalin in his generalissimo's uniform hung over the desk, and there was a small bust of Lenin on a shelf. Slavuta was a big-bellied man, bursting out of his uniform, and the folds of his neck hung over his stiff collar. He looked around the study and gave it his approval. "This is what I call living, Makarygin." "I don't know. I'm thinking of getting a transfer to Oblast level."
"Oblast level?"
Slavuta turned it over quickly in his mind. His was not the face of a thinker. The heavy jaw and fat cheeks were its strong features. But he was quick to grasp essentials.
"Well, there might be some sense in it."
They both knew what the point would be, and Radovich didn't need to know. Oblast prosecutors got packets in addition to their basic salary. In the Central Military Procuracy, you had to reach high rank before you could expect that.
"Your older son-in-law is a triple laureate."
"He is," the prosecutor answered proudly.
"And the younger one hasn't made counselor first class yet?"
"Only second class at present."
"He's damned smart, though. He'll make ambassador some day. Who do you think of marrying your youngest to?"
"She's an obstinate wench, Slavuta. I've tried to marry her off, but she won't have it."
"An educated girl like her. What's she looking for? An engineer?"
When Slavuta laughed, not only his belly, but the whole upper part of his body heaved convulsively.
"With 800 rubles a month? Take my advice and marry her to a Czechist. That's the best bet."
As if Makarygin didn't know it. In fact, he regarded his own life as a failure because he hadn't managed to break into that charmed circle. The dimmest little operations officer in the most out-of-the-way hole had more power and got a bigger salary than an important law officer in the capital. The whole procuracy was regarded as a pointless farce, not worth its keep. Makarygin's failure to become a Czechist was an inwardly bleeding wound.
"Right, then. Thank you for not forgetting me, Makarygin. Don't press me to stay. I'm expected elsewhere. And you, Professor, look after yourself. Don't go getting ill again."
"All the best, Comrade General." Radovich got up to say goodbye to the departing guest, but Slavuta didn't hold out his hand. Radovich's hurt look followed his fellow guest's broad, round-shouldered figure as Makarygin escorted him to his car. Left alone with the books, he turned his attention to them. He drew his hand along a shelf and, after some hesitation, pulled out a book and was making for a chair when suddenly he noticed another small volume in a motley red and black binding on the table. He picked that up, too. This other book burned his lifeless, parchment-skinned hands. It was Tito, Traitor-in-Chief, by a certain Renaud de Jouvenel, just published in a first edition of 1 million copies. Countless thousands of base, vicious, lying books had come Radovich's way in the last dozen years, but it seemed a long time since he had held in his hands anything so obscene. He skimmed the new book's pages with an old bookworm's practiced eye, and it took him 2 minutes to work out who had thought such a book necessary and why, what sort of reptile its author was, and how much additional animus it would stir up against innocent Yugoslavia. His eye was caught by this sentence, There is no need to dwell in detail on Laszlo Roik's motives for confessing. He did confess, so obviously he was guilty. Radovich, disgusted, put the book back where it had been. Of course there was no need to dwell in detail on his motives. No need to dwell in detail on the way interrogators and torturers beat Roik, tormented him with hunger and sleeplessness, spread him out on the floor, perhaps, so that they could pinch his genitals with the toe of a boot. Abramson, a prisoner of long standing, with whom Radovich had felt a close affinity from the moment they met at Sterlitamak, had told him all about the NKVD's little ways. He had confessed, so obviously he was guilty. The summa summarum of Stalinist justice. But Yugoslavia was too sore a point to touch on in conversation with Pyotr, then and there. So when his host returned, automatically casting a loving glance at the new decoration lying beside the tarnished older ones, Dushan was sitting quietly in his chair and reading a volume of the encyclopedia. "They don't lavish honours on public prosecutors," Makarygin said with a sigh. "They gave some away for the 30th anniversary, but only a few people got them." He very much wanted to talk about decorations and why he had been one of those honoured on that occasion, but Radovich lowered his head and went on reading. Makarygin took another cigar from the drawer and plopped down on the sofa. "Thank you, Dushan, for not sounding off. I was afraid you might."
"What could I have said to embarrass you?"
Radovich asked in surprise.
"Lots of things."
Makarygin clipped his cigar. "You're always sticking your neck out." He lit his cigar. "Like when he was telling us about the Japanese. It was on the tip of your tongue." Radovich shot upright.
"Because a filthy police provocation stinks 10,000 kilometers off. Dushan, you must be out of your mind. Don't dare talk like that in my presence. How can you talk like that about our party?"
Radovich hedged.
"I'm not talking about the party. I'm talking about Slavuta and his ilk. Why have we suddenly discovered in 1949 what the Japanese were up to in 1943? After all, we've had Japanese prisoners here for 4 years. And what's this about the Americans dropping Colorado beetles on us from the air? Is that true as well?"
Makarygin's bat ears reddened.
"Why shouldn't it be? And if it doesn't quite add up, it's still politically necessary."
The parchment-coloured Radovich began turning pages irritably. Makarygin smoked in silence.
"Should never have invited the man. Only let myself down in Slavuta's eyes. Old friendships aren't worth bothering about. Best to let them remain memories. The man can't even behave with normal politeness, show some awareness of what gives his host pleasure and what worries him, as any guest should."
He smoked on. Unpleasant scenes with his youngest daughter came into his mind. Whenever they dined without guests, just the three of them, in recent months, what should have been a relaxed and cosy family meal had become a dogfight at the table. The other day she had been pounding a nail down in her shoe, singing some meaningless rigmarole as she did so, but to a tune her father knew only too well. Trying to keep cool, he remarked, "You might have chosen a different song to go with that job, Clara. The wide, wide world's aflood with tears is a song people died or went to Siberia singing." Out of sheer wilfulness, or for whatever reason, she bridled and said,
"Did they now, noble souls? Went to Siberia, did they? Well, they're still going."
The prosecutor was taken aback by the impertinence and impropriety of the analogy. How could anybody so completely lose all sense of historical perspective? Barely restraining himself from striking his daughter, he tore the shoe from her hands and hurled it to the floor.
"How can you make such comparisons? Between the party of the working class and that fascist scum?"
She was so hardened that she wouldn't cry even if you punched her in the head. She stood there with one shoe on and one stockinged foot on the parquet floor.
"Spare me the rhetoric, Daddy. What do you have to do with the working class? You were a worker for 2 years once, but you've been a prosecutor for 30 now. Call yourself a worker. There isn't so much as a hammer in the house. Being determines consciousness. You're the one who taught us that."
"Social being, you idiot. And social consciousness."
"Take your choice, then. Some live in palaces and some in pigsties. Some ride in cars, and others have holes in their shoes. Which society are you talking about?
Her father was left gasping. The age-old impossibility of briefly and clearly explaining to foolish young minds the wisdom of their elders. You're just stupid. You understand nothing, and you refuse to learn.
So teach me. Teach me. Whose money do you live on? Why do they pay you thousands when you produce nothing?
The prosecutor had no answer to that. Or rather, the answer was obvious, but you couldn't come straight out with it. He could only say heatedly, "Well, what do you do to earn 1,800 in your institute?" His hard feelings toward his old friend were suddenly forgotten. "Tell me, Dushan," he said, "what am I going to do with this daughter of mine?" Makarigan's ears stuck out from his head like the wings of a sphinx. A look of bewilderment was strangely out of place on that face. "How could it come to this, Dushan? When we had Kanchak on the run, could we ever have imagined what sort of gratitude we would get from our children? If they have to take the platform and swear allegiance to the party, the wretches rattle it off inaudibly as if they were ashamed." He told Radovich the story of the shoe. "What ought I to have answered?" he asked. Radovich took a grubby scrap of chamois leather out of his pocket and cleaned his glasses. There was a time when Makarigan had known all the answers, but his mind seemed to have gone to sleep.
"What should you have said? You should have told her about cumulative labour. Education, special qualifications, are a form of accumulated labour and are more highly paid."
He put his glasses on again and looked hard at the prosecutor.
"Still, the girl is basically right. We were warned often enough."
The prosecutor was taken aback.
"Warned? By whom?" "We must know how to learn from our enemies."
Dushan raised a bony finger.
"The wide, wide world is drowned in tears. How many thousands do you get, while a cleaner gets 250 rubles?
One of Makarigan's cheeks twitched. Dushan had become spiteful, envied others, because he had nothing himself.
"You've gone crazy in your hermit's cave. You're out of touch with real life. You'll come to a bad end. What am I supposed to do? Go along tomorrow and ask to be paid 250 a month? How could I live on that? Anyway, they'd take me for a madman and kick me out. Nobody else is going to refuse the money."
Dushan pointed at the bust of Lenin.
"Remember how Ilyich refused to eat butter during the Civil War? Or white bread? Did people think he was mad?"
Dushan sounded almost tearful. Makarigan warded off his attack with splayed fingers.
"Bah! You mean you believed it? Lenin didn't go without butter, never fear. In fact, there was a pretty good staff dining room in the Kremlin even in those days."
Radovich rose. His foot had gone to sleep, and he limped over to the shelf and picked up a framed photograph of a young woman in a leather jacket holding a Mauser.
"Didn't Lena side with Shlepnikov? Do you remember what the workers' opposition said?"
"Put it down."
Makarigan had turned pale.
"Don't disturb her memory. You're just a diehard, a diehard."
"No, I'm no diehard. I just want Leninist purity."
Radovich lowered his voice.
"Nobody writes about it here. In Yugoslavia, there's workers' control in industry."
Makarigan gave an unfriendly laugh.
"Of course, you're a Serb, and it isn't easy for a Serb to be objective. I understand, and I forgive you. But,
they had reached the brink. Radovich fell silent and shrank into himself, became a desiccated little man again.
"Finish what you were saying, you diehard, you,"
Makarigan angrily demanded.
"According to you, the semi-fascist regime in Yugoslavia is real socialism? And what we have here is a degenerate form? That's all old stuff. We heard it long ago. Only those who said it are in kingdom come now. You'll be saying next that we're doomed to perish in the struggle with the capitalist world. Am I right?"
"No, no."
Radovich shot up again, his face radiant with prophetic certainty.
"That will never happen. The capitalist world is consumed by much worse contradictions. Great Lenin foretold, and I firmly believe, that we shall soon witness armed conflict over markets between the United States and Britain.